Green. So how many of you are baseball fans? Can I get a show of hands? Anybody like to watch a little baseball here and there? I am. I don't watch it religiously. I'm a Cubs fan, and my business buys season tickets. We share with a couple other businesses to the Tin Caps. And in baseball, three strikes, you're out, is a great policy. In fact, at the Tin Caps, not only do they do that, but they've put a pitch count in place, which has made the games much more watchable because they get done faster and you're not there all day or late into the night. But I can imagine if they began to change the rules, if they said, you know what, maybe we should give the batters four strikes or five strikes. Those games would go from a few hours and they would drag on forever and ever. So in baseball, three strikes, you're out, works pretty well. But we found in other areas of life, just because it works well in baseball and we understand the concept, in our criminal justice system, it's been kind of not so great. The idea was if you were a violent offender, if you were doing things, then your third chance, you've had all the opportunities, and now we lock you up and we throw away the key. And it turned into where the idea of it was you had three bad things happen, or you showed that you had this pattern, to almost three strikes happening from small little things adding up even in one incident in front of a judge. And we began to fill our prisons with people that probably shouldn't have been locked away for a long period of time in prison. Many who probably would have done better in rehab or something else. And I'm not trying to get political here, but we have these things, these kind of isms that we hear in our mind, and we say, oh, that's true because it sounds true or because it rings true. Well, one of those is an example for Moses. It's one of the famous stories about how he strikes this rock, the passage that was read from Numbers by Beth for us this morning. And these stories, they're two stories that happen. They sound very similar, but they happen a large distance of time apart to the same rock in the same place. And Moses strikes the rock the first time upon God's command, the second and third time on his own accord. But because of that third strike, Moses was out. It was because of that third strike that, at least as many of us understand and we read this scripture, that Moses was told he would no longer be able to enter into the promised land. The people of Israel would go and cross over without him. This is painful and it's hard for us to understand. For some, it's led to this theology, or at least it's been one of the check marks against God, that somehow the Old Testament God is this mean, rigid, unforgiving God, where the God of the New Testament is loving and kind. But the truth is, it's the same God. God is the same yesterday, today, and always. So this morning, I think it's important for us to unpack these two experiences nearly 40 years apart and understand what God's doing there, because in doing so, we can realize that God does not treat us in a three strikes, you're out way, in the same way he didn't treat Moses harshly with three strikes, you're out. Instead, God is doing something much deeper as he prunes and crafts Moses and Aaron and Miriam and the other leaders of that generation into who he wants them to be. And he is preparing the next generation under the leadership of Joshua to finish the task, to start the new nation of Israel, not wandering in the wilderness, but in the promised land. So begin to dig in. I think it's important for us to compare these two miracles. Again, in Exodus 17 and Numbers 20, we see both events are very, very similar, yet very, very different. The first in Exodus is at the start of Israel's wandering in the wilderness. And as we read this, I think maybe you didn't have the same mindset I did, but as I'm preparing to preach these, and the theme has been the people are grumbling, And Moses has to handle that. I'm like, I don't want to do another sermon on complaining. I've already done enough. But I think it goes deeper than that. It starts out just that way, though. The people of Israel are grumbling. And what are they saying? It's that same, just very hyperbolic, oh, weren't there enough graves in Egypt? You could have buried us there that you had to take us out into the wilderness. Why do you do this to us? This, as soon as any trial or difficulty came. But in this miracle, God is patient with Moses, and he's patient with the nation of Israel. Then we see in Numbers 20, it's the same place. They've circled around 40 years later. They're at the same rock, and they're thirsty again. They're complaining again. And if I was Moses, I think I might have lost it here. I mean, talk about deja vu. Haven't we done this enough? Haven't we been here before? And here God does not tell Moses to strike the stone. Instead, he tells Moses to speak to the stone, and we'll dig into that a little more in just a moment, so that again, water could be there to nourish the people. Both happen at the same place named Meribah, which means quarreling. So we'll start in verse 5 of Exodus 17. The Lord answered Moses, go out in front of the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel and take the staff in your hand to which you struck the Nile. So it's important here that we understand that now it's not just about Moses doing this miracle, but he's saying, I want you to take the elders. I want you to take other leaders with you. I want this to be a team thing. This is not just about Moses looking great, but he's bringing others in to understand that God doesn't just lead through Moses, but he leads through his people. Just earlier to this, one passage back, or maybe two passages back, we see a title given to Miriam, Moses' sister. She is now called a prophetess. She is a female voice of leadership to the people of Israel. We also have Aaron, their brother, who is the priest and is doing the priestly duties and rites. We're expanding this beyond Moses, and the elders are coming in. God is showing how good he is to the entire assembly, that they will understand and they will trust him. These visual symbols of the staff striking the rock, God didn't need to do that. But he chose to, much in the way that a church may put stained glass windows in, as an illustration, as a way to tell the story over and over again, because this generation was raised in Egypt. This generation was not raised at the foot of a parent that was teaching and preaching the scriptures. They did not have the Old Testament even yet at this point. That comes later. We get the law on Mount Sinai. This generation, their mindset was warped and it was trained and it was shaped not by God but by Egypt. And that's why when everything gets hard, they constantly go back to Egypt. Maybe not in the flesh, but in the heart and in the mind. God's working with them, and he's so patient with them to undo that, to reshape them. So he brings the elders and the assembly of Israel, and he goes and he strikes the stone. Okay, verse 6, I will stand there before you by the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock and water will come out for all the people to drink. So Moses did this in the sight of the elders of Israel. So God is working to bring this leadership team, bring this nation, reshape their mind and their heart. So look, Numbers 20, verse 8, we see just a very similar story, but yet couldn't be more different. God says to Moses, take the staff, and you and your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together. But notice how it's different. He doesn't say to strike the rock. He says, speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community so they and their livestock can drink. Put yourself in this moment, not as Moses and not as Aaron, but as one of those elders. 40 years ago, you saw Moses strike the rock with the staff and water was given and God provided a miracle. There early in your wandering, in your reliance on God in the wilderness. Now 40 years later, yes, this moment of deja vu, it would feel very similar. But you're standing there, you're gathered together, and this time Moses doesn't even have to strike the stone. God's power and His provision is there, and all He has to do is speak to it, and the rock gives water. That would be a beautiful capstone on this journey that the people of Israel had had, but unfortunately, in ways that I can speculate on, but I'll never know for sure because I'm not Moses. Moses is like 120 years old now. I mean, that's older than most of us can even imagine being. And Moses is getting a little cranky. I don't know if Moses is a little hangry. That's a term we use in our house. I have daughters that if they haven't eaten, they're not always real nice. They get real grumpy. I don't know if that blood sugar drops a little bit, but here, Moses doesn't obey God. And it wasn't because Moses didn't love God. Moses isn't outwardly being rebellious, but he's frustrated. And fair enough. I'd be frustrated with my people too. But he misses the point of what God's doing. And he strikes the rock two times. And God lets water flow. But the consequence is that he tells Moses, you can't enter the promised land. And there's so many that on the first read of this, like, wow, God, really? Have you been there when a parent is disciplining a child, and not violently, not beating the child, but they're disciplining the child, and you don't know the background, you don't know the story, but you hear the consequence, and you're like, whoa. Geez, that seems kind of mean. At one such occasion, when I heard that, there was another parent, we were at a public pool, and another parent had heard the other parent. So I'm just kind of standing watching. I don't know if that makes me right or wrong in this story. The other parent is addressing their child. It's not in anger. It's not in wrath. But the consequence seemed harsh. It was about the child running and just jumping in without any supervision in the pool. Another parent came up to chastise the first parent. Say, I can't believe that you would be so harsh with your child. And I listened as the parent shared that this was like the third time the child had jumped in, and the last time they nearly drowned and died. Because that wasn't enough for them to listen and not just run in and jump into the water when they didn't know how to swim and didn't have a life jacket on. And even that parent who came to confront them about how harsh they were silenced and they were stunned and like, oh, okay, I understand. I understand. Child looked old enough that maybe they should have been able to do that on their own, but I believe there was some autism and some other things going on. But we don't understand. The point is, we don't really know what God's doing as He disciplines His child. In the same way, we don't know what the stranger's doing when they discipline theirs. There's a backstory and there's a history and there's goals and purpose that we don't fully realize. And I think we have to acknowledge that here. That God is doing something. And He's doing something in Moses. But to us, it feels harsh. So let's look at the consequence. We see in Numbers 20, verses 12 and 13. Again, this is 40 years after the experience we see in Exodus, give or take a few. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, because you did not trust in me enough. That word enough is so important. to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites. Again, it's about honoring him in front of the community they lead. You will not bring this community into the land I give them. These were the waters of Meribah, where the Israelites quarreled with the Lord, and where he proved holy among them. Make no mistake that God is holy. One of my favorite lines, I've mentioned this before, is from the Chronicles of Narnia, and it's talking about Aslan. And Aslan is the Christ figure in the story of Narnia. He's the king of all of Narnia, the creator of Narnia. And one of the little girls is afraid, and she says, is he safe? Is he tame? And the other animal says, no, he is not a tame lion, but he is good. The same thing is true for God. I struggle sometimes when we sing songs like, I am a friend of God. And we are his friend. But we can't see this as like the buddy-buddy relationship we have with some of our earthly friends. He is our friend and he loves us dearly, but he is holy and he is good and his purposes are so much higher and better than ours. And sometimes we get too comfortable. We get too comfortable saying, okay, God, I'm going to do it my way. We'll get you next time. We'll do it your way next time, God. We see that throughout the Exodus, God has used Moses and Aaron and Miriam to lead Israel into faith, to show Israel his power, and to raise up the next generation. But while God's power was clearly on display, so was their humanity. If you go back, and we don't have time to go into all of it, but if you go back a few chapters in Numbers, you see that Miriam had this problem where she would complain and grumble against Moses because she didn't like who Moses remarried. So Moses took on a wife of an Ethiopian woman, and Miriam's like, I don't like this. No, I don't like her. I don't like what she's doing to my brother. But God said this is what Moses was called to do. And don't we see that in our families and in our situations where like sister doesn't like brother's new wife and now there's quarreling and there's conflict. And God said to Miriam, can't do this because you're not just you. You're leaders of Israel. Everyone's watching. You can't behave this way. And as a symbol, God gives her leprosy for a time. But he also heals it. We see Moses in this situation. He's angry. He's frustrated. We see other situations with Aaron. But the point is they're all human and none of them are perfect. And I'm thankful for that because I'm not perfect either. Because I'm human, because you're human. So there's a certain amount of satisfaction that God chose here in the story of the Exodus, that he chooses in the time of the judges, that he chooses in the time of the kings, that he chooses with his disciples who become apostles, not perfect people. Jesus was the only one perfect. The rest of them were flawed. And God was constantly shaping them and molding them and pruning them to become who he wanted them to be. He used them in spite of their flaws. He actually used them through their flaws at points. And that was true here. In Numbers 21, we see that Miriam, the sister of Moses and Aaron, the sister who watched over Moses in the Nile, like I said before, the prophetess from Exodus chapter 15, the feminine side of leadership to Israel, dies. But it's not because of God's judgment or consequence. We know this because the Bible says, it's very simple about how it shares it. We just get six words. There Miriam died and was buried. Because at her age, as Moses' older sister, so if Moses is 120, Miriam's older, probably by about 12 years. It wasn't a surprise. After Moses is given this decree, that he will not enter the promised land. It's in the same chapter at the end that we see that Aaron dies. Now, this is partially about Moses. Let's not go to the extreme and take that away. Because God is pruning Moses through this. This is part of God turning Moses into who God wants Moses to be. And sometimes when he prunes limbs, it hurts. There are times that God will bring consequences to us, and it's painful, but it's part of us becoming who God wants us to be. There are times that God takes away from us things that are good, but they're not for our best. Because he wants to make room, he wants to open the door in us for what he's doing. And that can be confusing. Those are things that we deal with as we mature in faith and we realize, okay, God, but I wanted this and this wasn't wrong. It wasn't sinful. Why did you take this thing away? And it's only later, and maybe it's only in heaven, that we see how that pruning and that shaping in the potter's hands. We see these illustrations, one of pruning. I don't know that the bush or the tree likes having the limbs chopped off. I hope they can't feel things. That would make my vegetarian daughter really, really worried. But it's cutting, and it's to bring new life and more life into other areas. We see the illustration of the potter and the clay. Imagine if that clay had feelings on the wheel as it's being stretched and poked and prodded to become that beautiful vessel. The refiner's fire. That gold has to go through tremendous heat to be refined and made pure. These are the illustrations that God uses for our discipleship, for our sanctification, as he makes us more and more like him. And Moses, at this point in his life, is at a pretty advanced state of this. But Aaron dies of natural causes. Miriam dies of natural causes. Moses is still strong because of God's hand and his blessing. The scriptures go out of their way in the passage of his death there. I believe it's Deuteronomy 34. It's the very last chapter of Deuteronomy before we change over and before we get really deep into the story. Joshua. There it says that Moses was strong. He was of sound mind. He was still a strong leader, even at his advanced age. But God says it's time for something new to happen. So he's pruning Moses. He's shaping him. But I also want you to hear that he's not being harsh with Moses. See, if God was really that mad at Moses, if he was being harsh with Moses, he wouldn't do what he does next. We see in Deuteronomy 3, chapter 3, verse 27. And then we see the same story or a very similar story in Deuteronomy 34. It says, go up to the top of, I don't even know that I can pronounce this in English, Fisca. And look, it's a mountain. It's Nebo later that he goes up on in Deuteronomy 34. And look to the west and to the north and to the south and to the east. Look at the land with your own eyes, since you are not going to cross this Jordan. Does something very similar at Moses' death. He takes him up on Mount Nebo, and he has him look. This is in Moab, just outside the promised land. And he has him look north, south, east, and west. And this is not God rubbing salt in the wound. It's far from it. He's saying, I have my reasons that you cannot be the one to lead the people into the new land. But I love you so much that I want to take you up to the mountain, even at your last moments, and I want to wrap an arm around you, figuratively or spiritually speaking, and I want you to see the prize. I want you to experience it, not on the ground, but from 10,000 feet up, where you can see the whole picture. I want you to see it from my perspective. I'm inviting you into that tremendously intimate moment with God. God doesn't say to Moses, you're garbage and you don't get to be a part of this. He says, no, I'm going to take you aside and I'm going to give you a special view and picture of what I'm doing. But as we're going to get into in just a moment, God had other plans, higher plans, and what he needed was for this next generation to have a new leader to take them across into the promised land. And we see that in the idea of the future being prepared. Again, Deuteronomy 3, verses 27 and 28. Go up to the top of the mountain, look west and north and south and east. Look to the land with your own eyes, since you are not going to cross this Jordan, but commission Joshua and encourage and strengthen him, for he will lead this people across and will cause them to inherit the land that you see. And don't for a second think that this wasn't painful for Moses. He pleads with God. He said, God, please. And God finally says, Moses, enough. You will not go into the promised land. But I'm going to take you up to look at it. And I don't believe this is just once. He takes him up at that final straw when God says, this is the end of it. No more discussion, but let me show it to you from up here. And then later again, at the moment of Moses' death and his very last act in the scriptures, he walks up to the top of the mountain. And again, in God's presence, he looks all directions at the prize, at the end of the destination that his leadership had brought the people to. But God's plans are greater than our preferences. And while Moses wanted to enter into that land, God knew that the people of Israel, this next generation, the children of those, the grandchildren of those that left slavery in Egypt, they needed a new leader, a different leader that represented another generation to take them into the promised land. And it wasn't for any lack of love to Moses. But in that final moment, Moses illustrated that his frustration with the people didn't allow him to do what needed to be done to be the leader of that next generation. And I want this to be an encouragement to us, not a discouragement. When we look at metrics for churches, it's hard. It's hard sometimes to judge what's a healthy church, what's an unhealthy church. Is it a healthy church because it has 1,000 people in it? Well, I mean, we saw with Hillsong, they had thousands of people, but it was not a healthy church. I've been in large churches that were far from healthy, so numbers alone don't do it. I've been in churches that baptized and brought a lot of people into the kingdom, and it didn't mean they were healthy churches. But I think like a normal life cycle, a healthy church is a church that is raising children, not just children in the flesh, but children in the spirit, that we're preparing that next generation. And when a church dies, it often dies because it stops. It just finishes and it doesn't raise up the next generation. There is this gap and there are no children. There are no new leaders being developed. And when that happens, that church is in trouble. But in the same token, you could be a small church that raises up a next generation of leaders and you could have an outsized impact in the kingdom. God is calling the next generation. You see, in the same way that Moses and his brothers and sisters, that all of those who grew up in Egypt dealt with the baggage of slavery, the baggage of Egypt's gods. Because again, remember, we haven't even gotten to Mount Sinai. And over, there's this grumbling, and then there's this worship of idols. After God has done all of this, there's this baggage in that generation. But there's also another generation. There's this group of young kids that have been running around that have been running around and playing, that have been watching as their parents wrestled and struggled, that have seen the victories of when their parents have stepped out in faith and have also seen the failures of when their parents haven't lived up to the expectation that God had. They're watching all of it. And that's the generation that we see Joshua come from. They see all of it. They've lived every day on manna and quail. They've walked with the Lord from being very young children. And it's easy for us to say, oh, that would have been a terrible life for a child. But I bet if you polled them, they would have said it was a magnificent one. Many of you know that when we moved back to Fort Wayne, Beth and I moved into Colony Bay, lovingly referred to as Felony Bay. It came up again because I have an employee that was looking for a place to live, and I said, well, I can call and see if there's an apartment there, because he was saying, I'm going to have to spend $2,000 a month to get an apartment. I was like, well, that seems expensive. And apartments are expensive. It's way more than it was when we lived there. But he said, I could never live in a place like that. Okay, I did for like 5 years. But whatever. We've had neighbors who talked about their children moving out, and they said, well, they can live anywhere, but they can't live there. And I'm going to tell you, for a moment, I almost felt a little guilty. I'm like, well, geez, my children had a lot of formative years there, playing with the other kids in the courtyard. Those were amazing years. Those were years that my kids got to watch us do ministry, watch us pray for people struggling with all sorts of things, watch us build relationships. And as I've talked to my children and asked them, what do you think about those years there in the wilderness at Colony Bay? And for the most part, they speak of it fondly. Our job is not to shelter the next generation. Our job is to live out our faith in front of them and put them in situations where we prepare them. We prepare them to take the church and the kingdom to the next place, into the promised land. Now, I get confused sometimes because I don't know if I'm more, there are days I feel more like Joshua, where Jerry has passed on more and more responsibility and roles here at the church to me, and I'm humbled by that. And there are days I feel more like Moses when I empower my own daughter and some of these teens to take on the next place. And I think maybe there's supposed to be that tension. But we cannot forget that God is calling us to make room and prepare the next generation to lead. Because the carpet will one day be replaced. Hopefully the pews will be refinished and shined up. We'll have new lights. We'll have new mechanicals. This church will undergo changes throughout the next 100 years. But the one thing that will be steadfast is the investment we make in the next generation and their ministry and leadership as they take over. I am so thankful and grateful for the years I had here at 14, 15, 16, at 22, 23, 24, actually 19, 20, I don't know. We were in Ohio at 23. But if it wasn't for Jerry and the leaders that were on the board and those of you who held my daughter in the nursery, at a very young age, we wouldn't be who we are today. And so just as Moses was called to raise up Joshua, God's calling us to raise up another generation. And sometimes that means there's pruning. And sometimes that means God takes some of the things that we would prefer and He has us do something different instead. We'll learn those things together in time. But I pray that just like Moses, you would yield yourself and say, God, Do what you do. Prune as you will prune. Lead as you will lead. Because while I would like to enter the promised land, I care much more that God's people does. If I have to stand on the sidelines, so be it, as long as God's people get where God wants them to go. Worship team, would you come forward?